This is the current federal tax developments for the week of July the 18th, 2016. Current federal tax developments are brought to you, as always, by Nichols Patrick CP and your State Society of CPAs. We're going to take this week's entry is going to be taking a look at the issue that late may not always be better than never, as we'll take a look at a number of cases coming up. In fact, this week's cases, we'll start with that case from the Ninth Circuit that looked, and when the Ninth Circuit was able to deal with the issue of whether a late filed return could qualify for bankruptcy discharge, whether the liability there could, they managed to sidestep the issue that the other circuits had looked at as to whether that ever could happen. Also, the Department of Labor and the IRS have announced significant new proposed revisions to the Forms 5500 that would take effect in 2019. We also are seeing a case where the IRS decided the birth of a child was an unforeseen circumstance that allowed a taxpayer to get an exclusion for the sale of a residence. We have a state court that tried to solve a problem where the decedent had an error that was created when his financial advisor moved from one firm to another, but unfortunately the state court couldn't fix the federal tax problem, and the IRS has issued the 501c3 notice rules. So that's all coming to us this week on the federal tax developments. We have a number of courses coming up now. And coming up in August, we have a few. Both Don Cochran and myself will be doing courses for the state of Washington. Don's course on August the 11th, Multi-State Taxation of Business. And on August the 12th, he'll be talking about the income taxation of trusts and estates, planning and compliance. On August the 15th, I'll be teaching a session on preparing complex 1040s. That'll deal with things like the net operating loss rules, the passive activity rules, other similar type areas, alternative minimum tax that come up in our more complicated returns. And on August 16th, I have a course that deals with preparing a Form 1120S. So be sure to check if you're in Washington, be sure to check the State Society website for those courses. They're all being held in Bellevue. And as I recall, they also are all being broadcast on the web, so you have your choice either way to take those courses. So we're going to take a look now and start coming up this week on what's actually been our developments for the week. And we're going to start out on our developments with that case we discussed that I mentioned right up front from the Ninth Circuit. This is the case of Smith versus the IRS, case number 14-15857. It is 2016, tax notes today, 13512 is a citation. It was issued on July 13th. It is an appeal coming up to the court from the district court in Oakland. The issue that had the problem here was that the taxpayer in this question, obviously he's in bankruptcy and he has a tax liability. But the issue became the taxpayer apparently had never quite gotten around to filing his tax return. And in fact, a number of years after he had filed it, the IRS issued a substitute for return on his behalf. Following that, a few years later, the taxpayer finally prepared a tax return that actually showed a higher liability than the SFR, and he submitted that return to the IRS. He tried to get an offer in compromise and was unsuccessful, so he eventually files bankruptcy. Now the question becomes, in bankruptcy, is this tax return, basically the liability on this tax return, eligible for discharge? The taxpayer was looking at the question, which has come up in a couple of circuits, a number of circuits other than Ninth Circuit, regarding whether the fact he had late filed the return in and of itself meant that we didn't have any other question to be decided. A number of circuits had made that decision, telling us that actually, you know, that basically, if you don't file the return on time, you don't have any chance of getting a discharge in bankruptcy. The Seventh Circuit in the case of Payne, Maroney in the Fourth Circuit, and Hinderlong in the Sixth Circuit all had held that way, that a late filed return under the current statute, the bankruptcy statute, could never be considered a valid return for purposes of a discharge. So no matter why you were late filing it, it would be irrelevant. Now the question became, was the Ninth Circuit going to join with those circuits and hold the same? Well, the Ninth Circuit took a look at this and said, you know, okay, the laws changed clearly. The bankruptcy laws changed since the last time we had ever looked at this issue. We had the Bankruptcy Reform Act, and the issue, this particular issue, had not come before the Ninth Circuit since the Bankruptcy Reform Act had been passed. So the Ninth Circuit said, okay, we're going to decide this one. But what the Ninth Circuit said was, fundamentally, the same basic rule applies. What the Congress did in the Bankruptcy Reform Act was enacted a definition of what's a tax return. The Ninth Circuit said, well, that's fine. We've got this definition. But the question still regards an issue of whether that return counts, because Mr. Smith clearly filed a piece of paper that clearly was a tax return. So the Ninth Circuit, and by the way, all parties agreed that there's a four-prong test here, that for an item to be a return, it must purport to be a return. There's no question that the one he filed purported to be a tax return. It also must be executed under penalty of perjury. He did sign that, so that's no problem. It must contain sufficient data to allow the calculation of the tax. It followed that as well. So now the fourth prong is the issue. Did it represent a honest and reasonable attempt to satisfy the requirements of the tax law? The Ninth Circuit took a look. Now, in this case, Mr. Smith, he's got a little problem here. He filed the return 7 years late, and he filed it after the IRS had put out a substitute for return. But he said, look, I filed a real tax return, and I did that. I put that in. That should count as a return for which a discharge would be eligible. It would be an honest attempt to comply with the tax law. Unfortunately for Mr. Smith, the Ninth Circuit panel didn't see it that way. The Ninth Circuit panel said, your case looks to us a lot like the case we decided under the old law of Hatton. In the case of Hatton, a taxpayer had essentially finally agreed he owed the tax only after the IRS had started enforcement activities against him. And he tried to come and say, well, no, actually had I accepted their substitute for return, so therefore I have a legitimate return. The Ninth Circuit in Hatton effectively said that what you had in this case was not an honest and reasonable attempt to comply with this tax law. You essentially complied with the law only when there was a gun at your head, where the IRS was trying to collect the money from you already for that return. That doesn't count as an honest attempt to comply with the law. In this case, though, Mr. Smith said, hey, but there's a difference. Unlike Hatton, I actually filed a return. You know, the opinion doesn't point this out directly, but I would assume he also said, and look, I even confessed owing more tax than the IRS thought I owed on the substitute for return. So doesn't that represent an honest attempt to comply with the tax law? The Ninth Circuit said no. Just like in Hatton, you only took action way late and after the IRS was already aware of your problem and was coming after you for collection. This super late file return just cannot be considered in any way, shape, or form an honest and reasonable attempt to comply. The Ninth Circuit also said, because these facts are so extreme and wouldn't have qualified under the old law, the Ninth Circuit has put off to a later date the decision of whether a late filed return could ever qualify. In fact, the court in passing said that that's an interesting and close question, but it's a question we're not going to need to decide today. So it does mean that at least for today in the Ninth Circuit, we still don't know for sure if a late filed return will be found to be dischargeable. That waits for another day to come forward. I guess that's somewhat good news if you're a taxpayer filing for bankruptcy, because at least you have a chance in the Ninth Circuit. It may be bad news, though, that you're going to have to probably go all the way to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals to get a decision, and that decision may still go against you in that scenario. Next up, we have the IRS and Department of Labor have issued new proposed regulations dealing with the Form 5500. This is proposed regulations. It is Federal Register document 2016-14893. The preliminary document was released on July 12th. It will be officially published in the Federal Register on July 21st. It is going to have changes that will affect the 2019 filings of Form 5500. Specifically, one of the big things that's going to happen here is they're going to add a brand new Schedule J for reporting health insurance programs, or health, basically health programs, medical benefits, and that will include health insurance programs. One of the key things that's going to come out of this, though, is that the Department of Labor, as part of this, is going to withdraw the exception that allowed a plan with less than 100 participants that was either wholly completely unfunded or partially funded with insurance and partially unfunded or fully funded with insurance from having to file a Form 5500. The only small plans that have to file a 5500 under the old rules for welfare benefit plans would have been one where the medical benefits were being administered via a trust and you would have to file for that purpose. Now the Department of Labor is telling us that we are going to have to file information returns on every program unless we're part of a group insurance account structure. That's a structure where basically you have a trust that is buying insurance, and a number of employers are participating in a group assured arrangement, I say, rules. And that in that case, the GIA is going to file a Form 5500 and a Schedule J for each plan under the GIA. So each employer-sponsored plan will have a separate Schedule J on that program. The Schedule J will require lesser information for a fully insured plan than it will for others. And the Department of Labor and IRS have actually issued the kind of outline of the proposed forms. They did not actually do mock-up forms. What they've done is put it in text. This is part of the reason why these proposed regulations go on for 777 pages. They're not short. We do have the link to them in our materials. In the article, I have printed out what the 8 questions that a small plan that's fully insured is going to have to answer. Now, again, this is beginning 2019. This very well could change before 2019, but it does suggest that clients who have never had to file any of these 5500 forms may very well find themselves shortly having to file the forms. Now, it does do some other changes besides just the health insurance. So, for instance, this also will have us file electronic filing. The 5500EZ will now be able to be electronically filed via the eFAST2 system when this takes place. Again, this is in 2019, as well as a number of IRS-only forms will be added to the eFAST2 system. So we'll be able to do more filings that way. So for traditional, once it's been filing 5500s, one caveat to note, though, in almost all cases, the revised 5500s are going to be asking for more information than have been asked for under the old ones. Copies of the entire revised 5500, at least in text form, and copies of the proposed instructions are available in this document. So you may want to take a look and download the document from our website to just take a look, see what's going to be required. Again, there's planning, certainly plenty of time to plan at this point, but you probably want to start getting your clients ready, the ones who are going to have to do filing, especially the people that have never had to file anything like a 5500, have no qualified retirement plan. You may have to explain to them this problem that may be coming up for them in the future. Next up, we have private letter ruling 2016-28002, issued on July 8th. This is a ruling, and first one we've had in a little while that I can recall, that deals whether something was an unforeseen circumstance for purpose of the exclusion of gain under Section 121 of the Internal Revenue Code, that is your sale of your principal residence. Generally, a sale of a principal residence, you can exclude up to $250,000 of gain, or if it's a married couple filing a joint return, $500,000 of gain if you have a residence that's been your principal residence for 2 of the last 5 years and which you've owned for at least 2 of the last 5 years. You do not have to have those two periods coincide with each other. So theoretically, you could have rented the property from a third party for 2 years. Then for whatever reason, you bought it at the end of that period, turned around, and then you rented it for 2 years, and then you sell it. Then the gain would be partially excludable. Again, I don't know why you do that, but there is that rule, no overlaps required. You cannot use this more than once every 2 years. So if you had a sale within the prior 2 years for which you used 121, you can't exclude again. And if you can't meet the two-year test, you generally can't use it. But there's an exception. Congress provided that you can qualify for a reduced exclusion if you can meet certain requirements. Now, in this case, the specific requirements that Congress provided were not directly met. They didn't have anything due to change of employment. They didn't have anything due to illness. There weren't any of the standard reasons, the ones that Congress said automatically qualify. But the Congress did write into the law a rule that said if the taxpayer has an unforeseen circumstance that causes them to have to sell the property before they meet the two-year test, that under regulations issued by the IRS, the taxpayer can take a reduced exclusion. The taxpayer in this case wanted to know if this qualified. They had purchased a 2-bedroom condominium, and essentially one of the bedrooms they'd been using for the taxpayer's office, for the husband's office, and also the child had been put in there. Now, after they bought the condo, turns out they discovered that another child was on the way. As you may guess, we take a look at number of bedrooms, things being used, and suddenly it doesn't look like this is going to work. After the second child was born, they sold the home. But this condominium hadn't been owned by them for 2 years or used by them as a residence. So the question they asked the IRS was, does this qualify as an unforeseen circumstance? The IRS, in this case, agreed that this is an unforeseen circumstance. And therefore, because of that, the IRS agreed that the taxpayers could exclude the gain on the sale of the residence. Now, remember, it has to be a circumstance that could not have been foreseen at the date the property was purchased, and it has to be the primary reason why the taxpayer is selling the property. Obviously, it might have been a little different question if the property in question had had, let's say, 4 bedrooms, and they really probably wanted to sell it for a different reason, but they said, oh, we've got another child. That might have caused a little more trouble. But in this case, I think it's pretty clear that the reason why they're looking for a sale is simply because their family no longer fit in this condo, so they needed a new home. The IRS granted relief. That's an important thing to remember, that the 2-5-year rule does generally apply, but there are ways out of that rule. So if your client does end up being forced to sell, be sure you consider where they can qualify for an exception to that rule. Finally, or I should say not quite finally, but next up, we're going to take a look at a problem here of a state court attempting to fix what I think all parties agree was just an oversight or error on the part of the decedent, or at least on the part of somebody related to involved with the decedent, that it was a set of 3 private letter rulings, 2016, 28004, 005, and 006, all of which was issued on July 8th. Now we have 3 private letter rulings because what we have here are 3 separate trusts. The taxpayer in this situation had done some estate planning. As part of the estate planning, it had been decided that the taxpayer was going to leave his IRA account when he passed away to 3 separate conduit trusts. Now, as you recall, that a conduit trust, and this is a trust drafted with the proper terms, a trust that essentially passes through, so any minimum distributions go into that trust and immediately go out to the beneficiary. If you have a conduit trust that meets all the requirements of one, you can look through to the beneficiary to get a life expectancy, and that allows us to essentially have a stretch out IRA. So for instance, if the beneficiaries are the grandchildren, we may be able to, after the decedent passes, stretch out payments from that IRA for an extremely long period of time. And by having it in the trust, we have a trustee who can assure that only the minimum distributions come out, that the grandchildren can't reach in and use that money to, let's say, buy a Porsche. So they had done this type of planning. They had all the beneficiary designations properly handled. But then the taxpayer's financial advisor changed firms. And we've all seen that. We have that happen to clients all the time where the advisor goes from one firm to another. Now, of course, when that happens most often, the taxpayer doesn't want to stick with the old brokerage firm, you know, because they were not loyal to Merrill Lynch. They were loyal to Fred. So Fred's not with Merrill Lynch any longer. So now they want to move their IRA from Fred's old location, Merrill Lynch, to, let's say, Fred's new location with UBS. So we get these documents to transfer the IRA and open new IRAs at UBS. Here's where the problem came in. The taxpayer was given forms to open the new account and apparently filled out by an assistant of the financial advisor who had put down as beneficiaries for the IRA the estate of the decedent, did not transfer over the trust as the beneficiaries. Now, the taxpayer, you know, the decedent in this case, signed those forms, but most likely, and it seems highly plausible, that the taxpayer never even considered that he or she should have worried about what was listed there as beneficiaries. The taxpayer just figured, I'm only moving my account from brokerage A to brokerage B to follow my financial advisor. Shortly after that, the taxpayer, the decedent, dies. After the decedent died, we basically, you know, look at the IRAs, and suddenly the estate discovered and the trustees discovered that they weren't the beneficiaries of the trust. So what ends up happening at this point is they go to a state court and ask for those documents to be reformed and instead substitute the trust as the beneficiaries. The state court agrees it was an error on the part of the decedent, and it says retroactively we're going to treat this as if the beneficiary had always been the trust. That's fine and good, except as the IRS points out, the fact the state court changed that retroactively does not mean it will be respected for federal tax law. We are still here with what's effectively the concept many of us have thought of in the past of how this works, and this reinforces it, that while you can subtract beneficiaries after the date of death, you can't add them. In this case, we're trying to add individuals who are not listed as beneficiaries of the IRA after the date of death of the decedent. Because of that, the IRS says, regardless of what the state court says, these trusts do not count as designated beneficiaries. And because of that, you can't use the life expectancy of the children. What's going to probably end up happening here, children or grandchildren, we're not sure what level was in. What almost certainly is going to happen in this case is they're going to have to use just the remaining life expectancy of the decedent at date of death, as weird as that sounds. But what we're also going to end up having to do is go back and understand that we're going to get money coming out a lot faster than we had expected it would happen. This means that it's very important for you to ask your clients to carefully check who beneficiary designations are listed. And anytime there is a change in custodian, even if a custodian is acquired, it's probably a really good idea to ask for another copy of who's the designated beneficiary and to confirm with the state planning council, if they've been involved, that the beneficiary designation agrees with what they think it should be. Finally, the IRS filled in a hole that we had. In the PATH Act, this is Treasury Decision 9775 and also proposed regulations, REG 101689-16, as well as Revenue Procedure 2016-41, issued on July 8th. The PATH Act at the end of last year added a rule that said an organization that plans to operate as a 501c4 organization, that is a social club, has to notify the IRS of their intent to do so within 60 days. Now, 501c4s, as we may be aware, have been somewhat controversial. They have been part of that whole issue that came up with the IRS's tax-exempt group and the flagging of certain organizations that appeared to be potentially, in their view, not qualified based on their names. Well, C4s have the right to do some political activity, but it can't be the major portion. They also do not have to apply for an exemption ruling. They can, but they don't have to. Now the issue becomes, so an organization could form as a 501c4. It's still going to file 990s or the 990 postcard, but it doesn't have to do an exemption, so it doesn't put the IRS on notice. With the law changed last December, now an organization that begins operating as a 501c4 has to notify the IRS within 60 days that it plans to operate as a C4. That does not mean they have to make an exemption request, because this was not what's going on here. They simply notify the service. The IRS had delayed the effective date of this because they didn't have forms ready. They now have it ready. Now an organization which has been formed to be a 501c4 will have to electronically file Form 8976 within 60 days of when it begins operating. An organization that was formed after December 18th of last year that began operating as a 501c4 also has to put this form in, unless they've already notified the IRS, and the regulations provide an exemption for those organizations. If they already notified them by filing for an exemption, or if they've notified them by filing a 990 in the interim. But otherwise, if they have not notified them already by July 8th, they will have to file this notification within the 60-day time frame. The ruling here in the revenue procedure tell us what has to be included in that notice. In essence, the things you're going to have to tell the IRS. It also tells you that if you don't provide everything that is required, they'll reject the notice and refund your user fee. It also provides rules if multiple applications are received. They're basically going to reject the second and beyond and process the first. Or they'll also send back notices if organizations apply for this. They're supposed to reject them if they're not actually organizations that are required to file this form. So we'll see how all of that works. That could be kind of interesting as we look at that background. So in any event, this is coming up. Again, if you have organizations, 501c6s, be sure that you take a look at this and understand and talk with those organizations about the need to file this. Also, for new organizations going forward, be sure to understand it. The problems likely to occur with individuals who previously had C4s, knew they didn't need to do anything, and form a new one, and now believe they still don't need to do anything, unfortunately, doesn't work that way. Now, remember, this is the time of year again. Your CPE, important to get that right. Be sure to check your state society's offerings for all the courses that are coming up and available in all the real interesting topics. You know, take a look. Their catalogs are out. You can read them. Sign up. If you haven't got your whole CPE calendar for this year finished, it's probably a good time to do so. You know, might as well start making decisions about what you're taking and when. So good time to get going. Be sure to check those catalogs. This has been the Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of July 18th, 2016. You can catch our daily updates online at currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. You can also sign up there for an email where we'll give you, when we post anything new, it'll come up and come to you the next morning in an email so that you can read it in your mailbox without having to visit the website. If you have any questions or any issues, or you want to ask something about anything that's come up on this topic, or you want some topic you think we should discuss on the podcast, be sure to send me an email at edzollers@currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. You can also follow me on Twitter at Ed Zollars. That's the easiest way, E-D-Z-O-L-L-A-R-S. And on there, I usually, whenever we post something, I will put a notice up there. Be sure to join us next week for more developments in the area of federal taxes.